Welcome to Writers Talking TV, brought to you by the Writers Guild of Canada. I'm Noelle Carbone, a screenwriter who's written for series including Rookie Blue, Cardinal, Winona Earp, and Coroner, and I'll be your host for today's podcast. A multiple Canadian Screen Award nominee, Mary Kale's People pulled off the seemingly impossible in presenting the issue of medically assisted suicide in the form of a dark comedy drama that managed to meld tones and keep viewers engaged through a strong-willed, assured, and conflicted lead female character. And today, co-showrunners of the series' third and final season, Tassie Cameron and Marsha Green, will take you through the creative process behind the head-turning series that pushed the question, how far is Mary willing to go for her cause, and kept audiences engrossed for three seasons. My conversation with Tassie and Marsha will include an audience Q&A. I hope you enjoy it. Okay, so Mary Kills People. If you don't know, you're in for a hell of a shock because this is unlike any show certainly that we make in this country, and unlike a lot of shows that they make in other countries, so you're in for a treat. Mary Kills People is a darkly comedic and soulful show about an ER doctor who moonlights as an underground angel of death, helping terminally ill patients end their own lives. Season one was well received by Variety, Vulture, the New York Times, and somehow even the Globe and Mail. Mo Ryan wrote in Variety that Mary is a smart, entertaining series that understands on a core level that nobody really wants to watch a TV show about medically assisted suicide, which is a compliment, but also kind of sounds like something your passive-aggressive mother-in-law might say. But she also said, Mary Kills People is one of the cult gems of television. The New York Times wrote, from Canada, home of crazy ideas like universal healthcare and kindness to refugees, comes another wacky concept, a racy primetime drama about euthanasia. The Globe wrote, Mary Harris is one of the most compelling original female characters in years, and I agree wholeheartedly. It's not hard to see how all these things can be true of a show with these two incredible women at the helm. I'd like to introduce the EPs and co-showrunners of Mary Kills People Season 3, Tassie Cameron and Marsha Green. All right, so the show has a very interesting origin story. So why don't we just start there? And just to say, instead of waiting till the very end after the screening to have you ask your questions, if you have questions during the conversation before the screening or after, just raise your hand and we'll do it then instead of you having to say, I have a question about a thing you talked about 25 minutes ago. Does that sound good? Yeah. All right. So Mary Kills People. She really, really does. How did you tell us the story?
Well,
tell the story.
The story of Mary Kills People. Tara Armstrong, the creator of the show, was fresh out of the Film Center. Tara and Marsha had gone there together.
We did not go there together, actually. She's the year after me.
What?
I know.
I would like to ask you to just hold your microphone to your face.
We did not go to the Film Center. And I want this on the podcast record. We did not go together. She is from the year after me. And we met kind of officially by working on Private Eyes.
I did not. I thought you guys were in the same year.
I mean, we thought we were going to surprise you.
Everybody.
And now everybody's
learning
about things. Okay.
Okay, so then scratch that. Let's start over. Kay. Mary Kills People. Tara Armstrong was a very talented young writer at the Film Center. And she'd written this script to get into the Film Center. Correct me if I'm wrong. And she, I believe, went off to Banff and was doing the rounds with that script. And I think Chorus got interested in it right away. It's one of those scripts that with the title that you pay attention. And then when you read the script, it just leapt off the page. So this was all happening at the same time that I was helping on the first season of Private Eyes. And so I was helping Shelley Erickson, who was the showrunner, that year. And we were reading writers to hire for Private Eyes, and I read Mary Kills People, and I was like, oh, shit, I'm jealous. This girl's got something. And I felt, you know, so we hired her on Private Eyes, and I was like, this is a really amazing script, but I didn't think much more of it beyond, wow, what a talent. And then a few months later, Chorus and E1 kind of approached me and said, would you be interested? We're wanting to make this show. We know that you're interested in starting a production company. Would you want to come on board and showrun and produce this? Which is when I reached out to my sister, Amy, who's sitting right there.
Amy Cameron, everybody. Amy Cameron.
And, And we had been talking about starting Cameron Pictures for a while, and it gave us a perfect moment, opportunity to do that and to be kind of the creative producers on a show that was already going and greenlit, and that I got to showrun in the first season, and then Tara ran in the second season, and then we ran in the third season. So that's sort of how it got started. It was one of those Cinderella stories that I think newer writers really hold on to those kinds of stories, because they don't happen that often, and when they do, it can be quite amazing, you know, career launching.
For sure. And you mentioned the title, which is so evocative and controversial, and I think maybe this is instructive for people who are writing their own material. Just a quick anecdote. Season one of Mary Kills People, there was a huge poster of it on the wall at, I think, the Bloor and Young subway station. And I was standing there, and these two women, probably, I would say, in their 60s, on their way to church, what looked like, button up, walked past the poster, stopped, looked at it, read the title, and went, one of them said to the other, "Mary Kills People, I don't think so." And then turned, and the two of them got on the train. And I was like, this is amazing. But also, it's such an evocative title and controversial. Like, do you think it worked in your favor?
I do. I mean, I think that as soon as you hear that title, you know that the tone is going to be unique, and it's not going to be some kind of issue-driven morality tale that's going to put you to sleep. And like, it's so irreverent and so kind of multi-layered as a title that I think you get a sense of the tone of the show right away, which is really helpful when you're watching it. You might as well know that you're in for something that's going to be a bit shocking on a bunch of levels. So wouldn't you say? Do you like the title?
I love the title. I feel like somebody once asked Tara about this, but I think it's a good point, the idea of it not being an issue-driven show. Like, you know, it was Mary performs doctor-assisted suicide to deserving people, deserving and terminal people. I mean, tells the story. It tells a really different story. But yeah, it has been a thing that I think has really helped us in a way, just kind of set the tone right off the beginning. And of course, the pilot is, when you read it, it kind of leaps off the page in that way.
And would you say, if you had a stack of scripts in front of you and you're looking to read for a room you're hiring for or something you're looking to develop, does a title like that make you pull it out of the pile sooner than something else?
Hell yeah. Yeah, I mean, yes, I think it's been...
Tassie said hell. Yeah.
I think it is, we all know, incredibly hard to come up with good titles.
Totally.
And you know, you and I know this from our time together on Rookie Blue, which was called Copper for the first year of production. And basically ABC came to us and said, it can't be called Copper. Nobody knows what that is. And we didn't really know what it was. And we were like, okay. And they basically gave us that title of Rookie Blue, which we all thought was dumb. But then... anyway, they were right. Yeah, I think it
was the perfect title in the end, but we were all like, that's so
cheesy. Yeah. And, you know, so coming up with the title is very, very hard. And I totally understand how, you know, that not everybody has a great title for every project. But yes, I think it really does help it distinguish itself right off the bat.
I think it's kind of like Private Eyes, which Tassie and I both worked on. And we were also trying to come up with titles for that show for a very long time, because it was called The Code, because it was based on a book called The Code. And people were like, they're going to think it's about coding or whatever. And we went through a lot of titles. And then they said Private Eyes. And we were like, what? And then they were like, put this song. And we're like, what?
But the song as in, like, that's a reason
that's
to name
selling.
It Private Eyes.
We could not believe that they were going to go with
yes.
As a theme song.
Having said that, though, there had been a lot of kind of debate about the tone of the show and whether, like, where it was going to be. And once we picked Private Eyes, it's like, well, I think we've set the tone of what this show is going to be, and that it was going to be light and fun and funny, and it wasn't going to be this kind of hard-hitting detective show. So it really does kind of speak to how, like, that title can kind of stand in for your tone and set the tone for the show.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, my opinion, I do love the title, because you know exactly what you're getting, and it sort of suggests that you're in on the salaciousness of it in a way that makes it like more sort of enjoyable, you know, like the comedy thing of you got to tell a joke in the first 30 seconds so people know it's a comedy kind of thing, like you got to have something to laugh at in the first however many minutes. whatever that rule is. You guys know. I don't know. Great comedy. I don't know what I'm talking about. But, yeah, I mean, I've been, I think that you can afford to be evocative and vague in cable, but I don't think you can afford to be evocative and vague on network. I think people have to know what they're tuning into, especially because there's a billion shows now and everything is called, you know, if you're too cute or if you're like too like cerebral about the title, like I think that people don't find your show. They don't give it a chance, whereas something like that is like going to grab you kind of right away, so...
Actually, in the first season of the show, we were pretty careful. Like, Mary actually very rarely referred to what she did as killing. Like, in the first season, we're pretty careful. I think there's only, like, one or two times that she, just once in episode four, I think, of the first season that she says it. So it was something that, like, kind of other people would say and was the title, but we felt that Mary herself would often say she helps people. Like, that's normally what she says when you watch the show. And that kind of evolved a little bit through, but we were... pretty careful about that in the first season.
And so season one was written before physician-assisted suicide was legal in Canada, but then it aired after it was legal. Yes?
Yes, it was becoming legal. I think it became legal about halfway through.
It became legal, I fear, like the week before we started shooting.
It was the summer,
right?
And
were you like, oh no, good for Canada, bad for us? Or were you just like...
Could it just be delayed a little longer? Yeah. Like, this is... It was a kind of a, it was a bit confusing there for a while for us because we're like, well, we don't want to be in the set in the past. And
although we did, Tara and I, we were like, what if it was the 90s? Like Dr. Kevorkian was like her mentor. Like we kind of
went down the rabbit hole.
And then Tassie said no. And then that's why Mary Kills People is the show you see today. So
it's sort of set in this non-specific in terms of like US versus Canada, you're...
Well, it became quite simple for the camp. We wanted her name to be Mary Harris. That was the name Tara had chosen for her, and we wanted that. And there were, you know, 8 million Mary Harrises in Toronto and Mississauga and Etobicoke. And so that was a problem. And also we realized that the legality of what we were talking about, like that there were a lot of legal problems in calling it a specific place. Every name was going to be a problem. Every location was going to be a problem. So we decided to make it this Port Denver, which is named after our line producer, our producer Norman Denver. And it was sort of this meant to be a kind of city on a lake, like a Hamilton or a Buffalo, a big industrial city, but where it was still illegal. And we figured that that would speak to Americans where, you know, it's illegal in much of America still. And also to Canadians who were still, it was very much in the news, we hoped. It was very convenient to have it be a made-up place for legal reasons.
And I think we'll, like, the idea of very rigid parameters around what your show can be, being seen as, like, almost paralyzing at times, but also providing you an opportunity to get specific about what your show is. We'll talk about that a little bit later in terms of, like, how season three came about and in terms of kind of what you guys were up against schedule-wise and timing with your lead. Did it take, because your show's atypical in that it's not a straightforward procedural, it's so much character. I think you said when we talked earlier, the A story is always Mary's line, regardless of patient. It's the patient, it's the personal. Did it take a long time to figure out what an episode of Mary is? Like what the necessary elements of an episode of Mary is are?
sorry, I was trying to think back to season. You know, I think my memory of it, and Tassie, you can say if you agree, is that we didn't really, that if there became any kind of formula, it was a bit accidental. Like the only things that we knew that we wanted there to be a death in every episode so that one way or another there would be a death. We assumed that would be a patient death, but we didn't know necessarily. We never had like it's going to take up this much real estate, for example. Like, you know, we would start with the story, like what was the patient story going to be, and then that might kind of inform how long it was going to take to tell that story. There were some where it was a little bit more straightforward. The person was older and had decided. There was one like in season one with the woman who had ALS where it was just more complicated and it was about consent and whatever. So you knew that was going to take more time. I feel like when we break that show, and then and now, it is a little bit more organic, a little bit about, okay, what would happen next, more so than we have to hit these things. And when we don't have, but we do hit certain things, which Tessa, you talked about on the phone, which was like the cop story, the family story, the patient story, like those. And when they're not there, it's intentional. And when they're not there and that hasn't been intentional, we feel it like, oh, it's missing something. It needs a little something here. What's this person doing? And we'll kind of go back to the drawing board. But it's very hard to break the episodes, I think, because we don't have a real formula that we follow. So everyone is like, well, it could be anything. Now, what do we do?
I do think what was interesting in the first, when we were sitting down to break the first season, because Tara had never thought about this as a, I mean, she, I guess she'd thought about it as a show, but she didn't come in with a roadmap or anything. She was kind of like, I don't know. And so I think what we discovered fairly early on, and I credit Mike Goldback for this, was that we needed a big bad guy. Like that we had the cop story and the kind of cat and mouse of Mary and the cops. We had the patient stories. We had the family drama, but we didn't have, that was not in the original script.
That's right.
Correct, right.
No, Grady was not veterinarian.
She used to
get the drugs. Mary got the drugs from a vet named Grady. It was like a friendly vet, I believe. And
yeah,
yes,
right.
And Mike Goldback came in and had this whole thing. And the other thing that it really helped was that it was because in that scenario, in the original scenario, Mary was responsible for getting the drugs. So it gave Dez kind of a tie to something else. It wasn't all like that was what he was bringing to the table. This, like, he could get the drugs and he had this drug dealer and whatever until Mary gets kind of entangled with him.
So that really, that was, it kind of cracked it open for us that we pretty well know that this show is about Mary and her life, domestic, patients, hospital, and that, and the cops or whatever investigation is tracking them, and that a villain who's in opposition to Mary and Dez usually, and that those three elements are pretty important to the structure of the show and to making it feel have enough twists and turns mm-hmm. to be surprising.
And also I think what it brought, which we didn't know, and like, you know, Mike brought it in and it was like, oh, this is good, and it kind of gave us another like plot to follow and gave us greater stakes in many ways. But I think, you know, Tara had always had the idea that, you know, what Mary's journey was, is she a hero or is she a criminal? And that had started really being about the cops. But by having these bad guys, it was always trying to draw the parallel between those people and Mary, so that she was looking at this person who was also making some complicated or shady decisions or whatever. And in each season, each villain, there is like an element of them that is similar to Mary, to for us to feel that push and pull, like she's our hero and we're rooting for her, but also, you know, she's kind of like this person, or kind of doing something like this person, or working with this person or whatever. So it ended up kind of thematically really working for us too, as in addition to being a good way to drive plot.
And you cooked up a doozy of a big bad for season 3, which we'll get to after the screening. You mentioned Mike in season 1. How do you choose? First of all, shout out to your writer, season 3 writers. Who are your season 3 writers?
Oh, who do we start with?
Your development. There's the development room.
There was Jane Maggs was in. She was on season 2, and she was in our. We had an early development room, which I basically can't remember because I had a brutal concussion, and I was like kept. It was in my house, and I kept crawling downstairs, like kind of in a coma basically, and just looking at these writers going, "Oh, I have to come back to bed." So it was Jane and.
Was Jane in the development room?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
I was not there. Laura as a party, who had been on season 2, was
the first round.
Yeah, was in.
And then in then when sort of Marcia came back in and we really dug in for reals, it was Matt Heater, Karen Moore,
Jane Maggs, and Justin Ruana.
Yes, and then Chris.
And then Chris Roberts. After.
So,
to help us.
And so, how do you choose the writers?
It's all you, Tessie.
How do you? Is it specs? Are you looking at specs? Are you like, what's the?
Yeah, I mean, yes, there's looking at specs for sure. If we don't know those people, I mean, the good thing about being around in this business for a long time is you know a lot of the writers already, and so you kind of go, I think this person would bring a lot to to marry. And so in many of the cases, they're people I've worked with or wanted to work with for a while. In some, I'm trying to think of brand new
I think
new
you
people.
Had not worked, not that he's brand new, but I think you had not worked with Matt Heater before.
I hadn't. That was based on
interview.
Specs.
Yeah, he had written a spec. And Matt Heater, for those of you who don't know him, is of Degrassi fame. It's how he's best known. And so it's just, I think it's just a good example because he had a drama spec that, and so he, I think had been considered for season two and then came in.
He wasn't available.
And then came in season three. So even though he was kind of, had written most like half hours, it was best known for half hours. He had written a drama spec that they really liked. He liked the show. They had a good interview, I think, in second season. And then, and then came on for third season. So that was like a person, I don't think I had worked with anybody who had been in the room, but yeah.
I think that if there's any edge that people have gotten to kind of, whether it's as directors or writers on the show, it is being able to come in and speak very knowledgeably, very passionately about the show and what they love about it, what is doing it for them. Like, I remember when we were deciding on directors, it tipped the scale for me because one of the directors wrote saying, "This is why I love Mary." And it makes you feel like they're going to be as invested as you are when you get a sense that they strongly connect to the material and it's not just like, "I would like a job, please," you know? Yeah.
Any job.
Yeah. Like, "I'll take that job, please." Right. But when they really say, "Whether I get this job or not, I want you to know that this show means a lot to me for these reasons," and even if they're making them up, as long as they're a good enough liar, I'm quite taken with that.
And so in terms of like either using Matt specifically or somebody else, like what is it about that spec that jumps out at you that goes, "This is perfect for Mary"? Like, are you looking for different people who come to the table with different, like, someone who'll be good at writing Mary specifically or Dez or like the girls, like, or just someone who.
I think we're looking for writers that surprise us. I don't think that you're trying to find somebody who can write one character. And I feel that that's a very limiting way to try and hire a room full of writers, is like, "Oh, they can write just great teenagers, so they're just going to write the teenage," you know, in my case, I look for writers that surprise me plot wise, character wise, dialogue wise, even prose description wise. Right. You know, that where it's like, I wouldn't have thought of that. You know, that's interesting. That's what a cool way to put it. What a twist, what a honest, emotional moment. Like, people like that. That's what I look for.
Marcia?
I agree. I mean, it's so important in Mary, I think specific, like we were really interested in like having surprises. I feel like I'm just really attracted to that as like a writer and a viewer myself. I like shows that are surprising to me. I think what you end up really being, I guess I would say that, yeah, when you're reading the spec, you just want to read something that's really good and surprising and well-written and specific, probably point of view. I look for a voice a lot, like someone, where I feel like there's really a voice there, even if it's like other things are not perfect. There's like, oh, there's a real point of view. I think that's important to me. And then I think in the room, it starts to shake out a little what people are kind of better at or stronger at. And then you'd be like, oh, okay, yeah, this person is really good at like figuring out, like thinking about Mary's journey. And this a person is really good at like writing the girls or whatever. But I don't think we start there.
I know this is a very long answer to your question, but I
want to hear from you. So.
I mean, I think another thing is that on Mary, there is such a heightened, Mary could be quite campy if you let it, right? Like it's got a heightened sense of reality, a heightened sense of danger, the bad guys, the drugs, and I think that finding people who write very, very honestly and naturally was important rather than people who would take it to a new level of kind of absurdity or whatever. Like you need
sensationalism
or whatever. You need grounded writers who are going to, you know, take these kind of crazy situations and make them feel believable and real, you know?
And what makes a writer who leaps off the page for you good in the room?
I mean, it can range. it can range. Like some people are really, really prepared, and I really value that. Like they'll go, they'll leave the day at the end of the day, and they'll come in the next day, and they'll say, "I've thought about this, and I've researched this, and I have four articles that, you know, that they really prepare and think about it and come in with ideas." Other people are amazing, kind of riffers in the room, where they're like, "What if? What if? What if?" And they don't take offense if you're kind of like, "No, no, no," and they just keep going anyway. You know, firing ideas at you. Other people are much more thoughtful. Sit back, but when they sit forward with something, you know that it's going to like probably be amazing. And you know, and also just a good personality. Like life is too short to work in a room with people who you don't get along with and who are kind of difficult or take offense or defensive or whatever. So that the personality is a big part of it.
And you don't have to be good at every one of those things you said.
Oh, like God, no. And being able to own your own mistakes and where you're shitty at things and is great. Like, and vulnerability. Like, I think that Marsha and I believe in very safe rooms. We've worked together, and I think it's the same. Like, I think people bring their best work in when they feel safe enough to make mistakes, try terrible ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, like I have the worst ideas and I say them and everybody's like, "Wow, working with her, huh?" And I'm like, "Well, now you know, feel free to do anything, like suggest anything." But it's like a kind of like an openness to make mistakes, make stupid ideas. Bad version is a big thing we talk about a lot. Like the bad version would be this.
And then you're just hoping someone's like, "No, that's the good version."
Yeah.
And you're like, "Oh, is it?
Oh,
okay.
My God. It's so nice of you."
Great. I was just off the top of my head. I think that also I will say having worked with Tassie and for Tassie, I think one thing that's really good about the room and what really helps in terms of making it safe, because Tara was very good at this too, is that there is no ego in those rooms. That really it is like any like best idea wins, and you can tell Tassie that her idea isn't good and she's not like, "You're fired," you know, really. she gets Amy to do it. And then
Amy Cameron, everybody. Yeah.
But yeah, and it's so important because I think like for me, I think, having started out, like kind of working with Tassie all, it just, I feel like it really helped me like be in the room and be able to like say anything and just kind of push myself when I didn't feel like, "Oh, it's like, can I say this to Tassie Cameron?" Yeah. You know,
for sure. I remember one of the things I remember most about being in the Rookie Blue Room for those so many years, which was great, was
so it doesn't sound years, like it was great.
Was that it was a wonderful time for lots of reasons. Was that if we pitched you something dumb, you would always assume that you were misunderstanding our pitch. You wouldn't be like, "That's dumb." You would be like, "Sorry, I think I'm just not smart enough to understand what you're saying. Can you just say it again?" And then in the repitching and in the and when you have a showrunner, you know, one of the best, if not the best showrunner in this country going like, "I'm not smart enough to understand your brilliant idea. Can you just tell me one more time?" It really does make everyone feel safe to be like, "Okay, here's my dumb," like, "I'm just going to throw it out there," because, you know, the boss is okay with saying she doesn't get it all the time. And so it really fosters a really safe, and you probably were sitting there going, "These guys are dumb," but like, it's such a good scam.
That's not
to like make everyone feel safe.
You know, that's not the scam I thought you were going to say. What I thought you were going to say is that Tassie sometimes says, "I'll repeat it back to you," and then
it's
in that it's like, "Oh, I see." Yeah. So how that's not exactly
that's
working.
That's more of a scam.
Yeah, like, that's a little bit.
What I think you're pitching is,
and can I just say it back to you, and then we'll
tell me if it's right. Yeah.
Does that sound good in your ears?
Yeah. This is a roast, by the way. I don't know if you know this, but
welcome to the okay, let's just watch the show.
I think we've got is now a good time? All right, let's get in our cozy chairs.
Thank
and
you.
Watch this brilliant. So we're watching the first episode of season 3. So, episode 301. So season three, we jump ahead, I think you said a year and a half from last season?
Four months
in the season, but it was a year and a half. In terms of actually making it, we made it a year and a half later.
I thought you meant
in the show. Like, yes, 4 months-ish.
Okay, so a lot has changed since the end of last season. Mary super dupes pregnant. Ben is alive. It's winter. The hospice is up and running with Des and Nicole kind of co-show running it. Can you walk us through the decision-making process there? Like, was it an effort to make season three look differently than the previous seasons and stand apart in that way? Were you dying to shoot something in the dead of Canadian winter because you're masochists? What was the... How did we arrive at this particular setup for season three?
Well, we arrived at the setup because we heard... When we finished season two, we were all fairly prepared for that to be the end of the show. We were kind of like, we've made two great seasons. We're going to, you know, say goodbye to Ben. We'll, you know, we were sort of okay with it being a two season long project. And then when there was interest in a third season, we were like, well, let's explore this. And then as we were exploring this, we learned that our lead, Caroline, was pregnant. So she wasn't interested, naturally, understandably, in coming to work pregnant. And it was her first child, and she didn't want to work for another 4 months after having the baby. And so that put us in winter. And we were all kind of like, is this terrible? And it's going to be horrible and cold. And
it was.
And it was.
All of those things.
It was. We all became experts. Like Amy, my sister, has like all these electronic gizmos that heat up your feet with batteries and remotes. Yeah. And like it was really, really cold.
Yeah, she has that electric hand warmer. And then I'm like, oh, can I hold it? And then I just run away and I keep it for 8 hours.
So it was really born. I mean, this season, a lot of what you see creatively on screen was born out of practical necessity. We had to shoot in the winter because we needed to be on the air in April, and so that meant we had this short window. And then realizing that it would be so fun if our lead was pregnant, and asking her if she would consider doing that, and she didn't want to. But then realizing that we could kind of make her pregnant even after she'd had the baby. Which sort of really, the winter of it all and the pregnancy idea of it all really helped form how we started the season.
So the mango she's carrying around in this season is not, she had already had the baby.
She had the baby. Right. She had a four-month-old baby.
She was basically pregnant for 2 years. Yeah. You put her through. All right, great. Like an elephant.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was, I mean, I think she found it quite interesting because she was having her first child. And you know so I think she was bringing and the baby was 4 or 5 months old and in her trailer all the time and stuff. And I think she was really bringing a lot of these feelings that she had as a new mother to bear on the character. And I think it was, you can see it in her performance. There's a softness there. There's a kind of nuance about this pregnancy that I think really was helped by the fact that she'd just gone through it. So it was very interesting, I think. The pregnancy suit was a bitch. You know, like the belly and it all, we had to get it remade and it was, we're always eyeing it in the monitor going like it's slipping and it's like, and
oh no, the baby's dropping.
And like in the beginning, it was like, oh, this is going to be great for Caroline because then she didn't like, there was no pressure to lose the baby weight to shoot, right? It's just like, take your time. But of course she was just like dropping weight like crazy. And it was, so it was just getting like, not good. Yeah. Just getting not good all
so
the time.
So actor to just drop weight crazy. Like, we were like, if you'd asked me to be on screen 4 months after having a baby,
you don't have to diet. I'd be like, okay. And then I wouldn't. And then I'd gain weight is probably what I would do. I wouldn't just be like, and then the pounds just kept flying off. Anyways, that's a little
depressing.
So you thought you were closing out after two seasons. Is it because of Lifetime? Like, so Lifetime was not involved in season three. And, your U.S. broadcaster. And so do you feel like season three, because it was Chorus and Global, like Chorus / Global, do you think the season would have been what it is if Lifetime were still involved? Like, what's the Lifetime version of Mary that you no longer have to make this season?
That's a really good question. I mean, Lifetime was pretty supportive and great. Our executives at Lifetime were wonderful. These really cool women, and you know, they were certainly pushing us in the first two seasons towards extreme. You know, they wanted it very sexy, very controversial. They felt that Mary should have sort of almost orgasmic feelings about killing people. That they were very, very much going for a kind of controversial thing.
What? No, I'm just... Because it sounds like you're just like saying that, but that's like an actual note.
So you don't have to take all the notes is the lesson.
Exactly.
No, you don't.
But I think, yeah, they were pushing it, certainly. And they were, at the time, in the first season, Unreal had just been on Lifetime and was really popular and was really kind of well-known and well-received for these dark, complicated leads. And so I think they were pushing us. Sorry, and I shouldn't say that. They were kind of suggesting things like that. But when we were like, no, we don't think that that's going to happen. And they were okay.
Yeah, they were wonderful. You know? And the pushing and encouraging us to take risks and be kind of like brave and out there was really, I think, really good for the show altogether.
And I think sometimes like in the first season, when they might be like, you know, where say Global might have been more like, ooh, you know, we've never done anything like this. And like Lifetime being like, oh, that's great. We love it. Like that probably helped too, you know, to have these two people, to have two different broadcasters kind of bringing that sensibility to it.
But in terms of what would have been different, I'm not sure anything would have been different. I think that...
More money.
More money. Yes, that would have been nice. Yeah. We maybe wouldn't have gotten away with the opening tease on Lifetime in the States. I would have been surprised if that made it through.
It's such a great tease.
But for the most part, not really. Nothing changed.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing is, I feel like on network TV in this country, especially, there's an idea of what a female lead can and can't do, what that female character can and can't do. She needs to be checking in with her kids all the time. She needs to be, and do you feel like maybe having Lifetime go push it even further? Like women can be anti-heroes in the same way men can be anti-heroes. Do you feel like that sort of informed who, like how far you were allowed? Because we always have this question of likability, and the female characters have to be likable and they have to be beyond reproach and they have to be like, do you feel like having Lifetime go like, no, like these women on Unreal are like kind of the worst, gave you permission to go a little further with Mary than maybe you would have?
It's funny, as you say that, I was thinking that in the first two seasons, we got a lot of notes about Mary and her kids and being with her kids or whatever. And then this season, we didn't really get that note. And as a result, Mary's basically never with her children. And bad things happen because of that. I would say, I do think, from my memory of it, I feel like Lifetime was not as concerned about the mother factor as Global was. And I don't know, I think it was always a bit of like a balance, really trying to be like, okay, yeah, like, you know, that she is going to be a mother who really loves her daughters and, you know, prioritizes her family. But also is a woman who has a calling and, Tessie hates that she says she had a calling and I wrote it, so that's why. That's why I'm saying that. It's okay, I stand by that. Mary has a calling, and you know, and that she, you know, and that also informs her decisions, and maybe it means she's not always going to make the right one, and maybe sometimes her kids are going to suffer because of that. I think we tried to we weren't trying to say like she's a bad mother or she's a negligent mother, but we also weren't trying to say like these are the ways you're a good mother and this is how she has to be all the time.
Right.
Oh, and keep in mind, if you guys have questions, pop your hand up and...
Yeah.
Can we hang on one sec? We're just going to get you a mic so everyone can hear you, and then the podcast listeners can hear your brilliant, brilliant question.
No pressure.
No pressure.
No pressure. So I wanted to go back about when you're reading writers' work, and I have a twofold question. The first is, would you consider reading a feature script for someone if you're staffing for television? And then the gentleman that you mentioned who was accustomed to writing half hours but wrote a 1 hour, was that of Mary Kill's people or was that a different 1 hour? And do you remember what show?
I don't like reading specs of existing shows. And when I'm reading writers, I prefer to read original material. So I would rather read an original... I'm not saying if they wrote on a show, I'll read that too. Like I'll read their Degrassi or read whatever they've written, but rather than them specking some show that does, you know, that I wouldn't want to read and wouldn't in fact read a Mary Kills People spec. That's only worked for one person that I know in this industry, and that's Aubrey Nealon, who wrote a spec of Flashpoint and then got hired.
I thought that was Larry Bambrick. Nope, didn't that happen to Larry Bambrick, too?
Oh, maybe it happened to both of them.
I think it also happened to Larry Bambrick, also on Flashpoint. So, just saying.
I prefer to read a 1 hour if I'm hiring for a 1 hour. I will read a feature. I will read a half hour for sure, especially if the writer comes with a good recommendation and if they seem like a viable, but I prefer to read something that's the same, at least the same length as what I'm working on, ideally, but original is best for me, for my choice.
I agree with that. I think it's just, I guess what I would say is that, yeah, like if you're writing 1 hours, it would be nice for you to have a 1 hour spec. I mean, I think is like in the case of Matt Heater, who was kind of best known for writing half hours, it was really good that he had a 1 hour sample, a 1 hour original, because it's like sometimes it's hard for other people to see like, oh, this person can also write in this genre. So the fact that it exists helps us make that case and be like, he might be known for this, but he wrote a great 1 hour spec. Example, we really like it. He's a great voice. He loves the show. Let's just do it. So if you had something, if you already kind of weren't working in the genre and then you also had like, then you're a feature, it's just even more like, because we don't necessarily only make the final decisions. We have the people that we like, but it also has to get approved by other people. And so it just helps sometimes when people have 1 hours, when you're working on a 1 hour, it's particularly when they're not well known to the network, to be able to say, oh, but they have this thing and whatever. And it's, I think it's probably a little bit more challenging when they're outside of that, if they're not well known. Like if they're a famous playwright, great. But if like barring that, I think it's more challenging.
So getting back to the kind of Canada US, you're saying maybe we wouldn't have gotten away with that tease, you know. It is one of the cardinal sins that he commits in the but it's so captivating and it's so like super interesting. But what I was going to say is an observation watching season three that I had was that, you know, physician-assisted suicide, such a hot topic, like Roman Catholic Italian family, that we love to talk about that and debate that and how it's wrong and how, not me, but my family, going down this path, and we, God, only God can choose when we check out and stuff. And so those patients we see in the first two seasons, very emotional, but... In season three, there was a sort of, my experience, it was much more emotional viewing those deaths in season three. And when I stopped to think about why, it was sort of like, it's because of what's happening in the US. We talked about this on the phone call, like all these states revoking reproductive rights and policing women's bodies and bodies in general. This idea of my body, my choice is in the bones of your show. And watching the season, I was incredibly moved by the agency that these patients have, even though they're end of life, like they get to say, and we see someone deciding last minute, no, I'm not ready yet. And then no one's pressuring that patient to go through with it just because it's inconvenient to sort of change up what was planned. Like the idea that like Mary and Des give their patients this gift of their body and their choice. And it's sort of like, that's an ideal that's venerated by your main characters. It's like a sort of reverse Handmaid's Tale where you kind of watch the show and you go, yes, that's the way it should be. Let's go back to that. Do you feel like that was kind of, I mean, it happened sort of after it seems like you guys were writing it, but is that.
I think I remember in the first season, there was this one point we were like kind of, we were, have various things on the boards at various times. But in the first season, there was also a storyline about a young couple who were very religious, and the husband is like kind of near death, and it's kind of like the vibe is Mary's kind of saying, you know, like he might not get better, and you know what she might do, and she kind of turns to the Bible for her answer of what to do, and that is the wife does, and that is, and so, and we had written on the board that it was like that this couple, it's like, you know, that they believed in God, and that the doctor in that season was kind of like, we can do this, we can do this, this surgery, that surgery, that he believed in medicine, and that Mary believed in choice, and that, so it was not, it was never so black and white for her, where it was like, maybe there were things that you could do medically, but that doesn't necessarily override what the person chooses to do personally. And so I think that that's always been really from the beginning, like part of the DNA of the show, or of Mary, at least as a character. And then I think like the world is like, now it's like resonating in a new way. I think there at that point, it was very much about doctor assisted suicide. And now I think we're seeing the way that ties into the way, yes, like having ownership of your body. And there was actually a woman who many, many years ago was fighting for the right to die. And I remember her when I was, it was actually before I worked on the show, I was just reading this article. And she was saying like, who owns this body? Like who, like, why does the government get to choose over me what I want to do? She had ALS. Anyway, so it really has always been, I think, a part of the show. And yeah. And I guess it was just infused in season three, maybe not so consciously, but that's nice to hear.
Hi.
Hi.
Just so many thoughts coming up in this conversation. I guess why a lot of people object is the slippery slope you go down to, like, is it really your choice? And that's why I love the fact in the third season that you brought in the nurse who was taking the choice out of people's hands and doing it herself. So it shows both sides. And I just want to know what you think about something I read in the news. There's an American state where unless you opt out, they're going to assume that you are an organ donor.
Oh, right, yeah.
So they are taking the choice away from you unless you go through the trouble of opting out of taking your organs. And what do you think of that, and how does that fit in with your message?
Ooh, that's a good question. Cause I mean, I'm so pro organ donation that I'm like, yeah,
not right now, you're using them, but like later.
As soon as I'm done with them, have them all, they probably will be of little use to you at that point. But you know, so it's funny, I've heard about that new law, and I was like, oh, that's kind of great, because it means that there's going to be a lot more organ donation. But then when I hadn't really thought about it from the perspective of taking your choice away, mm-hmm. I will need to ponder that more ethically. I'm not sure.
Because I think that people...
This is a debate that I have with my mom, who reads a lot of unhelpful articles that are circulated through her, you know, church community about things like that. I mean, working on a medical show for three, four years, I've never come across a doctor who would do that. And that's not to say there aren't, but that's sort of where I stand, is like, you... these people take an oath. These people spend every day trying to save lives. I'm not sure anyone's going to let you die so that three other patients they probably don't know, because the organs go all over, can live. I mean, maybe I'm being naive, but I'd like to believe that that's not, that doctors don't do that.
I agree. I heard this on the news too, and then I was thinking about it, and I guess what I will say is that I understand at least what I feel like I do kind of understand the rationale, which is that I think most people like do or don't want to do it. Like for some people it's like, yeah, like you're really pro organ donation, and that there are many people who probably don't think about it, and that if you knew you were dying and you had an organ that was going to save somebody else and you knew you were dying, you probably would say yes. But we're not in that position for the most part. And so we don't opt in. And then as a result, we've never made that choice. And then they go on. So I think in some ways, I think maybe the idea is to make people be like, okay, so now really think about it. Like, think about it now. And you can say no or you can say yes, but you're actually kind of being more, the choice is kind of more presented to you than I think before people weren't really thinking about it at all. So yes, that's what I have to say about that.
Great show. Loved every episode from beginning to end. Thank you all so much. Can you talk about plotting season three? Because the ending was killer to me. Like, I kept watching the show thinking, how are you going to end this? How are you going to end this? And for every character along the way. And did you have that all plotted out at the beginning of season three?
I'm going to say no. I'm going to say we did not. I'm going to say that Marcia and I were pondering how to end this right until the moment we won't spoil it. But when we started in the room early on, we had a very, very, very different idea of where the show was going to end. And I would say a much bleaker idea, thanks to old bleak girl here who was like, she was like, no, everybody's unhappy at the end. I was like, well, okay, well, so let's see when we get there. it definitely evolved over the course of the show. I think that there were a few things that we knew we wanted to get to at the end. And I think the most important one, and I hope this isn't a spoiler, but is in the relationship with Naomi and Jess and where that went, because for us that ethical idea of mental illness and as doctor-assisted suicide is the most thorny and most complicated and also the most relevant to Mary and her past and her formative world. And so I think that was the one thing we knew we really wanted to get to in this last episode. But a lot of the other stuff, we just felt our way there as we went.
Yeah, that's true. I think that is the only thing that once we knew we were going to do that storyline, we had an idea of how it was going to end. We had an idea of what the scene even would be, of how it would conclude. And I would say other things we knew, things that would happen along the way, like maybe things that might happen in episode 5 or whatever. But otherwise, it was pretty much, we didn't know. And we were in the room like early on. I was like, okay, let's just like be, if we were just fans of the show, like what do we want to see? Like, how do we want them to end up? And so I had some very strong ideas about what I wanted those things to be. And I wrote them on the board and I put boxes around them. And then as we wrote, the truth is that it wasn't ever like, and then we decided kind of outside, like, then we're going to do this. It really was how the stories themselves evolved. When we write, we do write kind of from the place of, and then what's going to happen next, and what's going to happen next. And as we did that, some of the things that maybe we thought abstractly we would have wanted didn't make sense for the story as it was unfolding and like in front of us. And that's why they changed. So it wasn't never really, we decided that they were going to have like, I think we did start like kind of being like, what would make us happy? But it wasn't so much of a happy ending or an unhappy ending, but rather what felt, I think, was the kind of natural conclusion to those stories that we had followed for this season.
Yeah. And I think that there was, like, I'm just thinking back to this episode and Nicole saying on the bed to Des, she's like, I practice sometimes in the mirror, no officer, blah, blah, blah. Like that, I think we knew, you know, when something feels right, we're like, she's going to say that, and then she's going to have to say that for real. And when, and it's tiny little things like that where you're like, oh, wow, she's going to say that to Des here. And then I know she's going to say that somewhere before the end of the season. And so that gives you a bit of a, a place to head for. And it sounds really vague, but sometimes just having three or four of those markers ahead of you can give you enough of a roadmap that you can find your way there.
Yeah. I was just thinking that on the... We shot the scene. We shot a scene from episode 6 that is very close to the end of episode 6 on the very last day of shooting. And I was watching Caroline in the scene. And as I watched it, I realized that it was very, it had like, it was kind of like a question had been set up in this episode, in the confessional of this episode, that was answered in that scene. And I never realized it, even though I wrote that episode, until I watched Caroline perform it. Like, we were doing rehearsal. And then I was like, oh my God. I was like, Caroline, you know what I just realized?
I was just like, we're so smart.
I was like, oh, this is so crazy. So it's like weird, because it's like, I feel like I'm not even like taking credit. I really didn't think about it when I was writing it that way. But when I watched it, and I think when you watch it, when you're watching this perform, it starts to be outside of you, I think, in a way. And so I was just like watching it and taking it in and being like, oh, that is kind of the answer to this question that was set up by Tassie in this. So sometimes it's just kind of like a nice, lovely thing that happens that you don't plan for.
I think it's when the show, when you really feel the show, and the show is sort of in your bones and you're true to the characters and true to the show itself, you have these happy accidents mm-hmm. where you do feel like, I think I might be smarter than I think I am, but it's just you following like the path you've set, and then these like lightning rod moments later in the season where you're like, oh my God, I think we just paid some. I don't even know how that happened, but you have to be like honest storytelling up until that point. Otherwise, you kind of don't get there. That's really. Can I ask a question about Jess and Naomi? Like the paralleling Mary's journey with the terminally ill patients, and for those who haven't seen the season, shame on you, but also Naomi has mental health issues. She's really struggling, and ultimately, plug your ears if you don't want to know, asks Jess to give her a dose of pento and kill her. And so you have Jess sort of going down this road potentially of the legacy of her mom and having to do this. The notion of paralleling Mary as an adult woman's journey with teenagers and teen suicide, and that can be problematic. I mean, I think you treated Naomi's mental health illness with empathy and kindness, and I think Jess was the perfect person to go on that journey with her, because she is, to me, the most empathetic character on the show. Were you like very cautious because of, you know, the epidemic of teen suicide? Like, is that something that you thought a lot about, or were you just like, that's the right move and we got to go down that?
I don't think that anybody could have accused us in this season of fetishizing teenage suicide on any level. Like, there's no, it's not 13 Reasons. Yeah. Like, it's not, it's just, I wasn't super worried about that, because it really, I think we were showing how tortured this person was, and that this was not an easy decision, nor was it one that anybody was going to take lightly, even including her. And so, we knew that it in some ways was the one subject we hadn't really tackled, was mental health. Like, do you help people die if they are like suicidally depressed, and especially if they're 16 years old? Like, and those are things I don't have the answers to, and I still mull them over all the time, you know, because like, it was to kind of go through three seasons of this and not address that really, really challenging question ethically was, I thought, impossible. You know, like, we had to put it on screen and talk about it. And in some ways that was probably the most argumentative the room got, was like, because people have different opinions about it. Yes, everybody deserves to choose. And then other people are like, not when you're 16, or not when you're mentally ill, or like, right. It's, and so it was really important for us to dig into that. So I don't know, do you?
I was trying to remember. I think that there was a point where, you know, truly when I think with that storyline and with those characters specifically, we always look for a storyline for them that is tied to Mary's story. And this did seem like the right one. And I think by the time I was having the thought of like, oh, so I guess it wasn't like we're going to tackle teen suicide. It didn't feel like outside of it in that way. It felt about these characters and about how that connected to Mary. And then I think somewhere down the road, I kind of had the thought like, oh, I guess we're talking about teen suicide now, and then being aware of what was going out there. But I think because it's so rooted in the show and in those characters, I think I just hoped that we, we're going to do justice to the storyline for them. And I think we did. There were things, though, that we did like want to hit, like warning signs or things that people would do so it would feel kind of real. But we're always kind of trying to make it feel as real as possible and have medical consultants and all of those things.
And I do think that the origin story of Mary Harris, the fact that she helped kill her mother when she was 16 years old because her mom was suicidally depressed and that Mary helped, is so formative for that character and that needed to come back and be addressed and kind of re-examined in the last season, where she talks about her ambivalence about that decision. That it's not just like, oh, I did the right thing. It's like, I don't know. And ultimately that was the answer we came up with, is we don't know. But that's what we tried to put on screen, you know, and from a bunch of different ways.
I mean, I think you did a beautiful job.
First of all, amazing job. The show is incredible. I'm curious, as a writer, I tend to be sometimes scared of controversial topics, but I wonder, do you kind of have an attitude where you really try to take them head on, like, and if it scares you, like, you see that as a good thing? I'm just kind of wondering, like, how, if you purposely force yourself to always get into the stuff that really, really scares you, or what's your process with those kinds of topics?
No, I would say, maybe generally speaking, probably I do on some, I am on some level nervous or apprehensive about it. But I think it's more, I don't know. I guess sometimes you get excited by the idea of tackling that thing, of doing something different. And maybe that kind of starts to outweigh the fear. And I think ultimately, whatever we're doing, and certainly on Mary Kills People, one thing is like to not just do it for like the shock and awe of it all, to try and make it feel like, for it to be grounded and real, like that scene, for all of its, you know, controversy, it's like we really tried in that scene to make it be like Mary is talking about something real. She is connected to this person in this place, and that is having an effect on her. And it's not like she's not taking it seriously or he's not taking it seriously or whatever. Even if they're making a complicated decision in that moment that they both have to make, and to just make that feel like it's coming from a real place for them. And I think once I feel like that's happening, then I can kind of, we were like, oh, yeah, I mean, we would probably get letters and with people who thought that that was wrong, and that's their right to say that. But I wasn't worried about it. I would be more worried about it, I think, if I thought it was, we were just doing it like, oh, like, let's be controversial. You know, it's just like, let's just be real and like do this thing, and then whatever happens, happens, and we'll stand by it.
Yeah, I think I used to be much more nervous about tackling controversial subject matters. As a younger writer, I would be like, oh, she needs to be nice and likable, and, you know, and I don't want to really talk about, you know, certain things. And there's still, I'm still sort of squeamish about certain things, but that's more just a taste thing. I don't like huge conversations about people's periods and stuff, but that's just like a taste thing. I don't know.
If you're submitting a spec to Tassie, maybe it's not about people talking about their periods.
If it's Fleabag, I want to hear it. But if it's like a cop show, I don't necessarily. Anyway,
that period episode of Rookie Blue really soured you on the whole thing.
It really did.
Anyway. The one that was called Diva Cup. Cassie was like, no, no, not on my watch.
No, I think I was more more shy about controversial things when I was younger. For me now, I'm like, whatever, bring it on. As long as I believe in it, as long as I can stand behind it and say I'm doing it for this reason and not just to be shocking or controversial. And like, if I'm doing something, if I'm working on something and writing something or supporting another writer who believes in what they're saying, I you know what? Bring it on. I'm too old to care.
Oh,
uh-oh. Oh,
I just think it would be...
Uh-oh. Oh, no.
To talk about the original idea of the depression with it being Jess how the network then also was weighing in at that point, just because it's an interesting... how you guys ended up switching it.
Originally, we were going to have Jess be the one who was suffering from mental illness and was Mary going to help her own daughter. That's where we were starting with it, because it seems like she's the central character. She's Mary's daughter. It runs in the family. Like, that felt realistic, that she might be, you know, this breakup with her girlfriend and that... she might be worried that mental illness is in the family, and that she has to get her mom to a place where her mom has to choose. The network, I think, very rightfully said two things, one of which was real buzzkill, like not a fun story at all. Whereas at least with Naomi, she's so kooky that there's still some entertainment to be had in her depression, weirdly. That was the first thing. But they also said nobody ever is going to believe that Mary would ever touch her daughter on any level. Whereas if it's flipped, and if it's Naomi's the one grappling with this and Jess is the one replaying her mom's decision, you can believe, and I think you do, like, it's a kind of a shocking scene what happens there, that she might go through with it. Whereas, and I think we thought it was a really good note, and we instantly switched them.
Yeah, good. And just in terms of tonally, what one character going through a manic phase or a depressive, suffering from mental illness versus, in terms of when you map out the season and you're looking at the patients and what they have and who they are, and do you try, because Rachel Antrill's character, Lucy, has a sort of joie de vivre that some of the other patients don't. And so are you trying to balance tonally, this death was like, very sad or depressing, whereas this one was, you know, a person who lived their life to the fullest, like the death we see at the beginning. Are you conscious of tonally making sure that not all the deaths and not all the terminal patients are sad, like that some of them are happy to, you know what I mean? Like, that is, do you go like, make sure that there's enough of this and not, you know?
Are you saying yes? Oh, I was going to say no. Really? Okay, well, let's hear you think the answer is yes and why I think the answer is no. And this is our process. Then you guys can watch that.
I think we want each death to feel different, each patient death to feel different, and that as every birth is different, every death is different, and that there are some... where it is like the opening of episode two, she's like, I slept with 100 men. I've traveled all over the world. I'm good, you know? And I think that can be true. And I think there are other people who are filled with regret. And so I think we were trying to make them feel different and, yes, balance the sort of really sad ones with some... like, I think that the death of the man in this episode is actually hilarious. In a sick way. Like, it's like heartbreaking.
All the laughter was coming from Tessie Cameron. I know. Cameron, no,
and I'm dabbing
front.
My eyes because she's like dabbing her eyes.
Like this.
When Mary says, I think he's tired, I'm like, oh my God, is that not the funniest thing she's ever said? To me, it's sick, funny, great. But anyway.
And your show straddles that line like very successfully. Like, there's not, and not every show can pull that off.
Well, and maybe we don't, you know, but to me, I was like, oh God, this is so sad. And then it's so absurd and funny yes, I would say we are conscious of it. Why do you say no?
Well, I guess I guess I feel like I've never really, I haven't been like conscious as in like we're looking at the patients and it's like, ooh, lots of sad ones here, better. I think, but to your point, I think, yeah, that there are maybe that we are trying to make them different. We're trying to make them different in many ways, like they have different conditions, they're different ages. So we are thinking about that, like that kind of balance. Like in the first season, it was very difficult to get anybody young. Like it was just like everybody needed to be like 80 and like so terminal and whatever. Like people were very worried about the idea. So even having this kind of one young patient that we have in season one, was challenging, and there's a lot of dialogue in there. You'll hear about how much he has done to possibly do something else other than making this choice. And this is for people to feel better about it. And I understand that it is hard, but what's so great about that is that he can want to do it and he can still be scared at the end. And it can still like it just because he's saying, I want this doesn't mean that some of them are going to be like, I feel great and I'm ready. And some people are going to be like, will you hold my hand? Because I'm alone and I'm scared. And I think that's kind of like, I guess, yeah, just kind of like the beautiful, like messiness of it. But I guess I've never thought about it as balancing them out, but just kind of like each person is, I don't know, just kind of honoring that their story, whatever it may be. And then maybe it does all. And then secretly behind the scenes, Tassie Cameron is balancing them all out. So they're not all sad and some of them are happy. That's what's happening, guys.
You're welcome.
You had previously mentioned one of every writer's favorite buzzwords right now, Fleabag. Is there anything that from that show or anything to that effect that's inspired Mary Kills People or even anyone in the writer's room or any ideas that you have coming up for future Canadian television?
I mean, sexy priest. You led with sexy priest.
Richard pitch us the... Recently, Tom pitched us the sequel. What was it? Des something something?
Oh, Des with...
Oh, fuck. I can't remember.
Des lives in Lucy's mansion with a bunch of ghosts. I can't remember. It wasn't great.
We're working on it still.
I don't know. Fleabag was not... I don't think it was a hugely formative show for us on this particular series. I mean, I think every writer who watches Fleabag... Yeah, is inspired by that show because it's so interesting and brave. And mm-hmm. I mean, and certainly I would say in some ways Killing Eve was more formative for us on this show.
Yeah, for this season, for sure.
Like it really, the twists in Killing Eve, the willingness to have women look kind of terrible and do terrible things and be in the room with each other as a real antagonist, I think helped inform season two and season three of this show probably more than Fleabag did.
Yeah, I think like definitely the way in Killing Eve, like to have your villain kind of present sometimes is quite sweet. That was something that is kind of mirrored in the villain. I was in season one, a very big influence for me was the girlfriend experience. I don't know how familiar people are with that show. But I watched that show. I was watching it and I watched like three episodes and then I called Tara and I was like, you have to watch this show. And then we watched it and it really solidified to us what we loved about Mary, which was that people wanted Mary, they wanted to understand everything about Mary right away and that she was going to be a bit of an enigma, that you weren't going to get in the first episode everything that happened to her, her backstory, why she did it and all of that, that it needed to be this thing that you were all, that part of being on the edge of your seat is not quite understanding that person and what drives them. And that show does it so well. You're kind of constantly trying to figure out why she's doing this and whatever. And watching that really for me, like made me like kind of understand how that was going to be like a really, really powerful in the show and what kind of was part of Mary being a bit of an anti-heroine.
We've sort of come up against it. Can I ask one last question, if you will indulge me all? So when Jill Soloway was at TIFF, they said sort of this famous thing that all writing is propaganda for the self. And so I know when I write, I try to make everything as gay as possible because that's what I want to see. What is your writing on Mary or just in general say about you?
I mean, I think that pretty well everything I write is about the tension between being good and being free. like being a good person doing the right thing and then being the renegade who is free to do what they believe in, even if it hurts people's feelings or is like, I think that that's my tension, that am I a good girl or a brave woman? And that's, so that I think that that's in Mary, and that's probably why I was attracted to it.
I think that I'm always, what like kind of fascinates me about Mary is how powerful it is when she is vulnerable, but how difficult it is to get her there. I think that's something for me as a writer that I'm always kind of looking at. And I feel like in the show, when I write something for Mary, I'll be thinking like, okay, like, you know, what's the truth? And then will she say the truth? Will she admit this thing? And that kind of is, you know, this storyline with her mother. Part of that is that, you know, Mary has asserted that, you know, she believes that people like deserve the choice and all of that. And that's true. And yet somewhere deep inside, there is a part of her that's not sure she made the right decision. And it takes her a long time to kind of really say that and articulate that. And that's just something that's really interesting to me always, like the way the secrets we keep, the kind of guards we have around ourselves to protect ourselves from being vulnerable.
Thank you for coming, and thank you to the Writers Guild for having this event. You've been listening to Writers Talking TV, presented by the Writers Guild of Canada. All the podcasts in this series can be found on the Writers Guild website, wgc.ca. Thanks to the team at TIFF Bell Lightbox and to our technical producer, Philip Vukovic. I'm Noelle Carbone. Thank you for listening.